We've seen 6 insolvencies just this year prior to Hurricane Ian.
Rescue and recovery efforts in Florida and a reckoning for the state's insurance industry. It's Monday, October 3rd, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. You might have seen how Hurricane Ian washed away the Sanibel Causeway. It was the only road connecting Sanibel and Captiva Islands to the mainland. Power is still out on both islands, and while rescue crews have helped some people escape in the days since the storm passed, aid workers say there's still a long road to recovery ahead. Maria Espinosa is executive director of FISH, a nonprofit that provided social services in Sanibel before the storm. They're now busy providing disaster relief assistance. She spoke to Celeste Headley.
The 5 years I spent on Sanibel, I would say the picture was a community really all working together to make it a better place for everybody. And I imagine after the hurricane, that is still what we are going to be doing. But there is just so much devastation out on the islands. It's heartbreaking to see the images as well as hear the stories of the people who have made it out and are now far away, displaced from their home.
For those who are familiar with Sanibel, many think of it as a place for wealthy white people. It's also a place that former Vice President Mike Pence vacations. But that's not the whole picture of who lives on these islands. Can you tell us how the average people on Sanibel are coping in the wake of this disaster?
Absolutely. I mean, the reality is many are not coping. My organization worked out on Sanibel 4 years, and we provided social service to people in low-income and vulnerable situations. And this type of disaster only exacerbates what they were already facing. Like I said, people are displaced from their home. Some of them are still in shelters. Some of them have found refuge in friends and neighbors' homes. But that is a short-term solution for long-term housing needs and other resources and support to the community.
So you and I have both mentioned that your organization generally does social services. That is a very different job than providing disaster relief. What have you had to do in order to pivot like this?
If it's one thing we are at FISH is adaptable. We are here to meet the needs of the community. We are relying immensely on our partnerships with United Way and Midwest. And, of course, we'll be talking to experts in this field to try to figure out how other areas have coped within a disaster like this, just to be able to service those in need.
I have to assume that it makes it more difficult that the 3-mile bridge that was destroyed that connected Sanibel to the rest of Florida, it must be difficult to get relief and supplies over there. What would you want to tell officials about the importance of restoring that bridge or making a connection?
It is extremely important. Like I said, one of the biggest issues that we faced before as a barrier island was having one way off and one way on. That is now eliminated, which means people out there need the resources. Our home base, the only place that was available to people to have social service resources, is now gone and unavailable. Our staff is working remotely, so the opportunity for us to go back on the island and be able to set up some sort of system for people to get the resources they need is critical.
So we've got about 30 seconds or so left here, and I'm sure some listeners are wondering why anyone stayed on a barrier island when there were warnings about a dangerous hurricane approaching. Are there people on the island for whom evacuation was either difficult or impossible?
Evacuation is extremely complex, and I can only tell you what I saw on the ground, but there were some people that it was out of their means to be transported off. It was also extremely quickly how fast that decision had to be made. You know, the storm of itself, we thought it was going to hit higher, and they had the experience of previous storms. So it's difficult for people for many reasons, one of them being resources, one of them just being difficulty with their mobility. And
Maria Espinosa is the executive director of FISH, which is a nonprofit doing disaster relief work in the wake of Hurricane Ian. Maria, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hurricane Ian caused tens of billions of dollars in damage in Florida. The state's insurance industry was already facing a crisis before the storm hit. So what happens now? That's after the break. Several insurance companies in Florida folded this year, and that was before Hurricane Ian. Charles Nice is an associate professor of risk management and insurance at Florida State University. He's one of many sounding the alarm about Florida's insurance crisis, and he told Scott Tong that insurers are leaving the state's most vulnerable areas.
Yeah, we are at the 30th anniversary of Hurricane Andrew. And we had seven named storms make landfall in 2004 and 2005.
Wow.
What we've seen is those larger companies have decided to, we call it managing their book of business. They've reduced their catastrophic exposure in the state of Florida. That left a number of smaller companies that were incentivized to form. We call them Florida domestics.
Okay.
But they're smaller insurance companies that mainly write homeowners in the state of Florida or Florida and some of the other coastal states that surround us. It's those companies that were suffering through the bankruptcies today. Those Florida domestic companies that have formed in the last 8 or 10 years are suffering large losses over the last 3 or 4 years. And we've seen 6 insolvencies just this year prior to Hurricane Ian.
Wow. So I gather in part because of claims with a lot of storms and also because of fraud?
In the last 7, 8 years, it's been a lot of what we call assignment of benefits claims. A roofer knocks on your door and says, hey, there was some hail in your area a couple weeks ago, and we're replacing your neighbor's roof, and all they're paying for is the deductible on their insurance. If you sign this assignment of benefits form, we can examine your roof, and oh, we found some hail damage. They replaced the entire roof. The insurance company never sees the damaged roof. And then if the roofer doesn't like the settlement, then they sue the insurance company.
Oh, wow. But I guess more broadly, given these big name brand insurance companies have either reduced their business in Florida or left altogether. Isn't that, to a certain degree, the market telling us something about risk in this age of climate change and more unpredictable weather, that for some of them, Florida is just not worth it? It's too risky?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, since Hurricane Andrew 30 years ago, we've had a 59% increase in population in the state. And that is double what we've seen nationally. Over 90% of that population growth has occurred in the coastal counties. And the other area where we've seen that growth outside the coastal counties has been the Orlando area. You know, so if you think about Hurricane Ian today, it followed a very similar path to Hurricane Charley. And, you know, we're seeing much more damage from Ian than we were going to see from Charley, mainly because there's more homes in the way.
The question is, given this shaky market, given a lot of companies have said, we don't want to do business there. I mean, if the market is an early canary in this coal mine on climate change, the state has stepped in to support an insurer of last resort. And a lot of people, because that's the only opportunity company they have, they bought it there. But why did the state do that? I mean, why wouldn't it said, let's let market forces kind of speak here?
Well, you know, if you're moving into Florida and you're going to have a mortgage, you're required to carry homeowners insurance from a rated insurance company. And with these companies leaving, you know, Citizens, that's the insurer of last resort you were talking about here in Florida, they are a rated insurance company. They can provide that coverage. But so they're doing it to help support the Florida economy. Citizens has over 1 million policyholders now, and it's growing. Likely what's going to happen following this storm is we're going to see faster growth in Citizens than we've seen over the last couple of years.
Okay. And how deep are their pockets? Do they have the money to pay the claims that will be coming from Ian?
Yes. So Citizens, after the 2004-2005 storms, was in the red. They were in negative. They have the ability to issue assessments. They issued assessments following those storms. And a lot of people here call it a hurricane tax. That assessment, they assess their own policyholders first, but then they can assess every property and casualty insurance policy sold in the state of Florida, except for Med Mal and workers' comp. So the example I always give is I moved to Florida in 2009. I had assessments on my homeowners, my auto, and my umbrella policy from the 2004-2005 storms, even though I never lived here at that time.
Wow.
Now, the good news this time around, Citizens has cash. You know, from 2005 through 2015, when we didn't have storms, Citizens built up over $6 billion in capital, which is good news. So they're going to be fine for this storm. What you worry about is the next storm that happens.
Yeah. Homeowners in Florida are already paying, compared to the country, huge rates to get homeowners insurance in the first place, right?
Yes. Yeah. So Florida, you know, has the distinction of being having the highest average homeowners insurance rates in the country. Just in 2022, rates had gone up anywhere from 35 to 40% across the state on average.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm up in Tallahassee with no claims. My rates went up 35% this year. So yes, we are paying more for homeowners insurance than most places. And that's probably what led to some of the fraud, is people have this feeling, since I'm paying such high insurance
rates, I need to get something out of it.
I need to get something out of it, exactly.
Charles Nice is Associate Professor of Risk Management and Insurance at Florida State University. Professor, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Coming up, the Supreme Court is hearing a big environmental case on the first day of its new term.
This case implicates millions of acres of wetlands throughout the entire country. And so it's a really critical case in terms of how we protect wetlands and also the role that wetlands play when we think about protecting our freshwater sources.
That's Camille Panu, an associate professor at Columbia Law School. She's talking about Sackett v. Environmental Protection Agency, one of the cases kicking off the Supreme Court's new term today. The Sacketts are challenging EPA restrictions on their ability to develop the land they own on Priest Lake in Idaho. The court's conservative majority could use the case to cut wetlands out of federal protections under the Clean Water Act. Bob Bond has been coming to Priest Lake since 1939. He's 83 years old. Bond and his wife live there during the warmer months in a cabin built by his father. He talked to Celeste about what the place means to them.
Priest Lake is a lake with a little extension to an upper lake that's about 25 miles long, just south of the Canadian border in the Idaho Panhandle. There are three large lakes in the Panhandle, many smaller lakes. This particular lake has always been felt to be the most pristine because it does not have a city along the edge of it or even a large town. When I first became familiar with this when I was a kid, there were very few people up here, and even though you might call it undeveloped now, there are thousands of cabins around this lake. But it's still a wonderful place and still a lot of wildlife. On the little cabin where I'm sitting on the porch right now, we've had deer, moose, cougars, even a mountain goat in our yard. And my wife and I are both avid birders, and we have seen something like 156 species of birds from our cabin. So that is the setting that we are in up here right now.
What's the most rare bird you've seen? Like, tell me about your bird story that you tell at parties.
Well, many years ago, we found a chestnut-colored longspur near our cabin. That was the first ever seen in the state of Idaho. We saw another one a few years ago, which was the fourth one ever seen in the state.
Wow.
We had a black-legged kittiwake in front of our dock, which is the first one ever for northern Idaho. And we've had a lot of rare eastern birds in our lot. We've had blue jays, Baltimore orioles that are unusual in this place.
So Priest Lake is in the news because of this Supreme Court case. A couple is trying to fill in the wetlands that's on their property. You've told us someone else is actually trying to fill in wetlands not far from your home in order to build something there. Without getting into the details of these cases, can you describe these wetlands that are immediately in danger and why they're important to that area?
I am not totally familiar with the wetland that's headed to the Supreme Court. The wetlands near us are much larger. There's a 60-acre area that has been wetlands on the very south end of Priest Lake. It has been undeveloped in my lifetime. And it's a unique wetlands from a bird standpoint, certainly. We've seen something over 160 species just on or immediately adjacent to these wetlands. The problem is that these wetlands flood many years with several feet of water on them. And to develop them means you have to fill that. And how much fill that would take for 60 acres, plus what would happen to the quality of the water in the end of the lake with all that fill. So there are several concerns that we have. We don't know what will happen. And how this would directly relate to the Supreme Court case, I don't know. I do know that it is estimated that if that Supreme Court case goes in favor of the owner, that that would put at risk something like 50% of all the wetlands in the country, which already are almost a rare habitat because of losses from development.
Are you worried about what Priest Lake may look like if everyone with private property is allowed to fill in the wetlands and the birds and the frogs and all of the other critters have no place to live?
Well, obviously I do. And, you know, people say, well, it's just one little spot. That doesn't make a difference. The birds can go elsewhere. But everybody doing that means that the birds really don't have anywhere else to go to. So, yeah, it worries us a great deal. And it particularly worries us here because of the quality of the water. This lake has had pristine water historically. And, boy, if they fill in this 60 acres of sand, it's going to certainly affect the quality of the water at this end of the lake.
Dr. Bob Bond at Priest Lake in Northern Idaho, one last question for you. What happens to the cabin in ensuing generations?
Well, we have three children, and none of them would let us sell this cabin. So it will go to our children, and they love it up here, too, and make use of it.
Dr. Bob Bond at a cabin at Priest Lake in Northern Idaho, now at the center of a big Supreme Court case that will have major implications for the EPA and for land everywhere. Bob, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. We've got a lot more from our radio show at hereandnow.org, including reporting from Alabama, where prisoners are on strike. They say they're forced to work, often for no pay, and subjected to inhumane conditions. And that the Department of Corrections is retaliating against them by withholding food.
Today we have ate 2 pieces of white bread and 2 spoons of grit.
Today's stories were produced by Gabrielle Healy, Lynn Menegon, and Jill Ryan. Todd Munt and Peter O'Dowd edited the show. Our technical directors are Max Liebman and Patrick O'Connor. The theme music by Max, Mike Moschetto, and me, Chris Bentley. The executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.